Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
When Shorts Were Short only concerns itself with what was actually a very narrow window in football history when teams wore, well, short shorts, the podcast will only cover football from 1954 when Umbro made their first England kit with shorter shorts, a design that was widespread within English football by the mid-50s, to 1992 when short shorts were all but finished as Umbro's baggy shorts for Tottenham's new kit ahead of the 91 FA Cup final quickly caught on. I'm Daniel Ruiz Tyson. This is When Shorts Were Short. If the shorts weren't short, we don't talk about it. There aren't many players who can say they're cherished by both West Bromwich Albion and Wolves supporters, but this week's guest made a combined 762 appearances for both, 626 for the Baggies and 136 for the side in famous Old Gold, who could not have been more in the doldrums when he joined them in 1986. Alistair Robertson spent 18 years at the Hawthorns, and after an initial stop-start time with the club, his Albion career really got going when Johnny Giles arrived as player-manager for his first spelling charge in 1975. And for the next eight seasons, him and John Wiley formed an outstanding partnership at the heart of the defence as Albion secured third and fourth place finishes in the late 70s and early 80s and reached the last eight of the UEFA Cup in 1979. While most would trace the club's decline to Ron Atkinson's move to Manchester United in the summer of 81, taking Remy Moses and, more importantly, Brian Robson with him, Alistair has a very interesting and different take on this. After a disappointing end to his time with the Albion, where after nearly two decades of service he deserved a much better send-off, he moved to Wolves in 1986 after West Brom's relegation. Wolves could not have been more of a mess, languishing in the bottom division, but under Graham Turner and the captaincy of this week's guest, Wolves secured back-to-back promotions and won the 1988 EFL Trophy at Wembley before Alistair's retirement in 1990. Here's Alistair Robertson. You were born in the village of Philpstone, a small village in West Lothian, Scotland. You're part of a huge family. Give us a little thumbnail sketch of your childhood.
We were so lucky. We had six sisters, five brothers. There was 12 of us, plus mum and dad. And it was a little village of 300 Philpstone. It was absolutely fantastic. You don't realise how lucky we were to be brought up in a little village like that. My dad was a miner for 49 years, and it was a mining little village, and everybody knew each other. Nobody locked each doors or anything. Everybody just walked into each people's house. Never any problems. No, we were so lucky. It was fantastic.
Was the fact that your dad did such a dangerous job, did it shape the kind of character you were as a footballer in terms of toughness, determination, staying grounded despite the glamour that came with being a footballer?
The one great thing about my mum and dad, they never promoted any one of us better than the other. Everyone was treated exactly the same. And my dad, his discipline was brilliant. You knew if you stepped out of line, you got a cuff round the ear. And the whole village, if you did anything wrong, the village would tell your dad. Or if it was somebody else that did it, somebody would tell their dad. And so you couldn't get away with anything. And the biggest laugh for me now, I look back, the policeman used to cycle through the village at 8 o'clock at night, and he'd stop and look at us all. He'd look at you and say, "Have you done anything wrong?" "No, honestly, you better not. I'll tell your dad if you have." And that's how simple and easy life was. We had no money. We had nothing, but we had love, care, affection. And my mum, how I look back and I think to myself, how on earth did my mum look after and cook for us all? It must have been horrendous for it. But I never heard my mum swear once. I never heard my mum ever shout at us. All she would say was, anything I'll tell your dad. And you knew then that was it. Fair enough, stop. But when I wrote my book, I went back to the village and I knocked on the door of the house. And I said to the lady that was in the house there, and I said, excuse me, you don't mind if I have a come in and have a look around the house? And she looked at me, she went, pardon? I says, no. I says, that room there, I was born in that room. And she actually says, you're not one of the 10 Robertsons, are you? I says, it was 12, actually. And then when you go in the house and you see the house, we thought it was huge. But when you go back into it now, you see how small it was. And I say to her, can I go up to the bedroom upstairs? And she went, why? I says, well, four of our brothers slept in that. There was two double beds. And she went, never. I went, yeah. And when you go upstairs to this bedroom and you look, there was two double beds in it. You wondered how there could be two double beds in this bedroom. But we all, you just fitted in with everything, and that was the way life was. And I was the bad one, really, because I had all the hand-me-downs. Everybody got all the hand-me-downs. But my younger brother, Derek, because he was a baby, he always got new clothes. And I used to say, this is unfair, this is. How come I get David's hand-me-downs? And I says, he gets new. But that's how the family was. We were all. And to this day, sadly, mum and dad have died now, and three sisters have died of cancer. But we all still keep in contact with each other. We all still go out together. It's fantastic.
Your dad had played a fair amount of football in his youth, hadn't he?
Yes, he was a very good footballer. And he probably could have turned professional or got better. But again, because of the mining villages, you couldn't go away and play football away from home, because it was mums and dads in those days couldn't drive them to the games or anything. But he was a very, very, very good player. And he was friendly in his village where he was brought up was Winchborough. And Willie Thornton, who was one of the directors at Rangers, they played together. And when I was a kid, Rangers were trying to sign me, he was talking to my dad all the time, God, get him into Scotland, get him into Rangers.
Rangers were the love of your life as a kid. Who were the Rangers players who helped fuel your desire to make it as a professional footballer?
Jim Baxter was my hero. Jim Baxter was absolutely out of this world. John Gregg, and it was when you saw people, players like that. And the reason I didn't go to Rangers, and this is how, I wasn't a confident kid. I didn't think I was good enough. When I saw Rangers play, and I didn't think I was good enough to go into that side. Alex Scott, and you look back, you look at all the players that were there, and you think, I'm not good enough for that. And that's why I kept on saying to my dad. My dad kept on saying, you're good enough. And I said, Dad, I don't think I'd get in the team. I don't think I'd get in the team. And that was, it broke my dad's heart, really, that I come down to England. And to this day, everybody says to me, why did you sign for West Brom? Because I was so lucky. Arsenal, Chelsea, Tottenham, Rangers, Man United, Celtic, Aberdeen, all the top clubs were after me. And they said, why on earth did you sign for West Brom? The reason I signed for West Brom was the head scout of West Brom, Joe Bailey, he was the only one I really felt close to. And he would talk me through all the things I had to do. He never ever said to me, oh, you'll be in the first team straight away, you'll do this. He used to always tell me, you've got to listen and learn. And if you see what all the rest of them are doing, if you think you're too good, you won't make it. You've got to make sure you listen. And it's quite funny, when I did sign, they took us down to Wembley to watch the Everton Albion final in 68. And they took my dad and my two brothers. And we went down and we went to the Park Lane Hotel before Wembley. And I can't believe it. We're in this Park Lane Hotel and you're thinking, good God, five knives, five forks, all these different things. I said to my dad, what do we do, Dad? He says, just look what everybody else is doing. Just do the same as what they are doing. And this Hugh Bailey, we started talking to us. And just as it happened, two young lads walked past. One was Asa Hartford. The other one was Les Glencantello. And he says to me, he says, Dad, when you get training, those are the two you've got to catch up to and beat, because those are the two best young kids at West Brom have got at the minute. So you've got to make sure you watch what they're doing in the reserves and everything, and you'll catch up. And to be fair, once I got in the youth team, then the reserves, I used to follow, I used to watch what they were doing every day, whatever they were doing, I would do. And I think it's catching on to something like that. And it was great. So lucky.
We'll come on to more of the football stuff in a moment. I just want to ask you, in your autobiography, and we'll mention the book at the end of this interview, one thing that really comes across, it almost feels like the few mistakes that you made in your playing career have stayed in your mind more than your numerous achievements. At least when you're discussing your career, these mistakes are referenced a few times in the book. Where does that hardness on yourself, where did it come from? Was it a family trait or was it something specific to you?
We were brought up, whatever happened, you had to get on with life. And in football, the biggest thing for me, and I look back, and that's why I keep throwing those things in, I look back, we had a great side together, but there was always something happened that didn't win us something. Like when we were in the youth team, we got to the Youth Cup final, we were 3-0 up from the first leg. Then we get beat 6 at Sunderland. And the reason was two players got sent off. So like you think, good God, we didn't win that. Then, of course, the 3 semi-finals we played in, I made mistake. Well, when I say mistakes, they weren't mistakes. It was just I kicked the ball against something and it goes in the back of the goals. But it was like 18 yards out. And it could have been stopped. And it could have been, and all the little things. And I think you just punish yourself because that's the way you are, that you think, I should have got that, I should have done that, I should have done this. And again, when Clive Allen scored that goal, well, when I had against his legs, the horrible thing was I had too much time to think. So I thought, oh, I won't give a corner away, I'll give a throw-in away. So I whacked it to go for a throw-in. And of course, if I hit it for a corner, he wouldn't have hit it. Because I was trying to be safe and put it out for a throw-in, hit his knee and goes back in the goal. And another bit beforehand, 5 minutes beforehand, we had just headed the ball clear. Me and Wiley were walking out. And Wiley says, well, I take it the replay is going to be at Villa Park, I hope. I says, yeah, I hope it is. I hope it's not down here. And it's like 5 minutes later, the score, and you think, good God. And all those things we laugh about now. Me and John, we just laugh about it. And you think, if only, if only.
Your dad gave you some brilliant advice, which you followed throughout your career, which was when you walk out onto the pitch, don't look at the crowd, which sounds very simple, can't have been easy to do, particularly when you're playing in a huge match with 50 or 60,000 fans. But you followed it throughout your career. Every time you stepped out onto that pitch, you were able to shut the fans out.
Yes, that's my dad. My first game against Man United made my debut. And he said to me, he says, now just remember, there's going to be a lot of people there. Don't look at the crowd because it'll make you nervous. Don't look. So I went out on the park, never looked. Before I'd gone out the park, I looked around, looked outside. But then once I got in the park, I never looked at the crowd. And it's so funny. The supporters used to say to me at West Brom, why don't you wave kiss or anything? And I said, well, I've never, ever, ever done it. So I will never do that. And it's just concentrating on the job. And I always thought, cross that white line, I've got to concentrate on my job. And all the rest of the lads used to wave to their wives, their kids, their everything in the crowd. I would never look up. Never, ever look. Everybody used to say that. Each lad said, no, I'm not looking up. My dad told me not to look up. I won't look up. It was something that I laugh about now. And at the time, when I started 17, 18, 19, to me it meant so much. But later on, it did make me laugh because I thought, no, the old man told me not to look at the ground. Don't look at the ground.
You broke into the Scotland schoolboys side in the late 60s. Did you feel in international terms that this was just the start for you?
It was so funny that at Stenhouse Muir, where the trials were, they had the probables and the ones that would get in. Well, the first two halves, I wasn't in the probables. And my dad kept saying, keep going because you're better than the other one. Keep doing what you're doing. Don't change anything. Then on the third half, I got into the probables. And I couldn't believe, I'm in the probables. And then the week after, they picked the team. And I got picked it. And I thought, good God, that was my dad making sure I keep it doing it right, do the right thing, don't change anything, keep doing what you're doing because you're by far better than that other one. And it just keeps you going. And to get picked in the schoolboy team, it was, for a family like myself and my mum and dad, it was fantastic for us. But it was so sad because my mum and dad couldn't afford to buy me the blazer, the trousers, the things to go. Because the first game was at Tottenham and you had to go in a blazer, this, that, whatever. So my mum and dad couldn't afford to buy me that. So my brother-in-law, he took me into Edinburgh to this, is it Austin's, the old shop?
Yeah.
And he bought me a blazer, trousers, shoes, socks, shirt, everything. So when I turned up from a schoolboy, I was like a model. I was so precise in everything that was there. And I kept on thinking, good God, I've never done this before, ever, ever. And, it, and that just shows you how great the family were, that everybody looked after each other.
And quite a few of your teammates from those schoolboy internationals, I think they were the likes of Kenny Dalglish, who I think was playing...
No, Kenny Dalglish I played in the youth team with.
Okay, okay.
And the schoolboy, it was Graham Souness, John Robertson. They were the ones that made it. When you say Kenny Dalglish, you can't believe this. Kenny Dalglish, me and him, we used to train for in the close in the summer, and we used to go to Lars, I used to train. And we were there... And I was centre half and he was my sweeper. The two of us played in the youth team four games together, centre half. So I was centre half, he was my sweeper. 6 years later, I'm playing against him at Liverpool and he's a centre forward against me. Incredible, isn't it?
What aspect of your game in your early days did you have to work on the most?
I think the one thing that I lacked was pace. That's the one thing I lacked. I wasn't fast. So I had to make sure that I got my tackles right and I made sure that I could read the game. So never, never, ever would I relax. I'd always be looking where the centre-half was, where the centre-forward was, and you had to know where that ball was going to drop because I knew that if I was standing next to someone, they would beat me to it because they'd be quicker than me. So you had to read the game, and that was the biggest thing that I kept up to myself. And that's what my dad kept on saying. You can't relax. You've got to make sure you're reading where everything is. And that's what I did all my life. So I did all my life.
You mentioned earlier, I think your debut came at home to Manchester United, October 69. You were filling in for John Kay, who had a stomach injury. West Brom 1-2-1. Do you remember anything about what you were feeling before the game and how you felt during the game?
I can still laugh about it now. I was in Diggs and Hilltop, 17 Brindle with Mrs. Hunt. And I had to get the 75 bus to where we used to have pre-match meals at Handsworth. And I had to get the 75 bus to there. And in the bus, I'm thinking to myself, I've got now. My dad's got to be here. He'll be telling me, make sure you're sure you do everything right. Listen, make sure you do everything right. And I just sat there, had my dinner. Then we used to have steak, and it was lovely. Had my steak. And Bobby Hope drove me back in his car to the ground. And Bobby and all the first teamers were brilliant to me because they just kept on saying to me, you're good enough, that's why you're here. Don't worry about anything. You're good enough, that's why you're here. And to go out there in front of a 45,000 crowd against George Best, Bobby Charlton, and like you think to yourself, how on earth are you going to cope? But everyone used to tell me, always remember, your first touch, your first tackle, your first header, all these things count, so concentrate and do it. And my first tackle was against George Best, and I've won the ball against him, and I thought, yes! Then all of a sudden, you just make sure that, and to be fair, how good the older players with me, they were telling me what to do anyway. So they made sure that nothing was going to happen. And as well, what was lovely, it was actually on the television, and it was on the telly that night. And my mum and dad, because when they told me I was picked, I phoned up my dad. Well, we didn't have a phone, so I had to phone the neighbour up the road and say, can you get mum and dad? I need to talk to them. So my dad comes up to me and I says, I never guessed, Dad. I'm making my debut tomorrow. He went, I know, West Brom phoned me already. We're coming down. They flew my mum and dad down to the game and they stopped in the county hotel in Walsall and then they brought them to the game. So I talked to them before the game and he just says, remember, just do what you've been doing. Don't look at the crowd. Do what you've been doing. And then after the match, it was a great match. We won. Fantastic. I actually got a mention on the telly at night that Man United manager at the time, says that was one of the best debuts he had seen in a young kid, because I was only 17 in a month. So it was just great to have been on the telly and everybody, you're looking at it. In those days, there weren't many people on the telly, was it? It's fantastic. Then on the Monday, when you come back to training, you're back with the reserves. You're back now, back down to earth. Whatever's happened there, you're back down to earth. And that's how everybody was. And that's the great thing about it.
Alan Ashman, the West Brom manager, was very confident in your ability. What did he do for you as a young player?
To be fair to Alan, he used to pull you aside now and again and just keep telling you, you're doing great, carry on doing it, make sure you listen, make sure you do this, make sure you do that. And he never put himself miles away from you. As a manager, he's up there. No, he would come and talk to us. And that was a great thing about West Brom at the time. We had, when we trained, we had three groups. You had the third team, the second team, and the first team. So as an apprentice, everyone in the third team was together in their dressing room. You had to make sure that you did all the jobs right and everything. But then once you start doing your jobs and you started going to the first team dressing room, you had to be, I was so careful that you did. But Astle and that used to take the mickey out of you. And he used to say to Bobby Hope, Bobby, will you translate for him? I can't understand the bloody word he's saying. And those were the things that bring you in. And then later on, Jeff used to say to me afterwards, the reason I took the mickey out of you, because I knew you were going to be a first teamer, so you knew when you come into the first team dressing room, you'd be part of it anyway. And that was how the whole team rolled together. And that's, I did it all through my career myself. Any youngster coming through that I thought was a good lad, we used to take the mickey out of them. And because that got them involved with the first team. And I did it to everybody.
John Kay was originally a striker, Jeff Astle's partner, and he was successfully converted to centre-back and you would replace him. He made a lasting impression on you early on because even though you were the young gun coming for his place, he was a huge help to you. And tell us something about that. And in your latter days at West Brom and Wolves, did that inform the way that you worked and supported the young players who were coming through?
Yes, Yorkie was absolutely brilliant. He'd come to the reserve games and you'd do something. And then the next day, he'd come and say to you, by the way, you were too tight, you know, you did this wrong, you did, make sure you do it like this, make sure you do it like that. And because that was the way then, and I used to say to him, Yorkie, I'm going to take your place. He said, you're going to take it anyway, but make sure you do this, 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 and this. And I did it all through my career. And going back to that, I remember at Wembley, when we were at Wembley watching the cup final, after about 70 minutes, I said to my dad, I said, good God, Dad, I said, how am I going to get in this first team with those two playing, John Talbot and John Kay? He went, 4 years' time, they'll be ready to retire. You'll be taking the place. And more or less, spot on to what my dad says, we were there. And that's where Yorkie was great. Even when I was in the first team, he'd come and watch me and he'd say, tell me after, well done, you did brilliant there, you did that, you did that. And that was something that just made you feel great. Then the one thing he did do, he made me drink. He took me down to the White House in Aldridge. Come on, you're coming for a pint. And I went, but I don't drink, John. You're coming for a pint. He took me down there and he says, right, you're having a pint, so this is what everybody has to do. We all talk together, we all get to know each other, and this means that on a Saturday, we kill for each other. And all those things that started all through your career, that's what it was like. That's what it was like.
The team reached the 1970 League Cup final where they're beaten by Manchester City after extra time. After that, you get your first run of games. I think you make 8 appearances.
Last 8 games, yeah.
What did that run in the team give you going forward?
Again, it was something that used to happen in our day. At the end of the season, if your team was safe, they'd bring the youngsters in. They'd bring the youngsters in and through. But because Yorkie Knapp was injured, I played 7 games. And like you think, how lucky it was that you now know a lot more about the football because the first teamers will talk to you. And they will tell you this and that, what to do, where to go, where you should be doing. And you learn from it. And it's the biggest turning curve. And it's like the scout told us, if you listen and learn, you'll get on. If you don't listen, you won't. Well, I used to listen, like, I've got to do that, I've got to do this, I've got to do that. And that made me, and that got me 10 times better.
In May 1970, you play for Scotland in the UEFA International Youth Tournament, which Scotland were hosting. East Germany win the tournament. Scotland finish third. By your own admission, you were a quiet kid with Scotland, at times feeling uneasy in that environment. Why was that?
I think, again, because there was people, Kenny Dalglish, all the people there, I just wasn't a confident kid. And I just kept quiet. I always kept out the limelight. I would never be the one at the front. Never, ever, ever, at any time in my career, would I be the one at the front. It was just something that I was like that all my life, as a kid all the way through. And maybe that's why I just didn't get to the next step. Because when we finished that, again, we got great people talking about us. John Brownlee, everything. We were getting told that we'd be in the under-21s, we'd get a full international calf. All the other lads went on and did it and got it. But just the September after that happened, I broke my leg. And I was out for a year. And I think from getting pushed forward in the press and in the paper and everything, to all of a sudden not be mentioned for a year, that's when everybody else overtook me. And that's when I just didn't catch up. And then it took me another 6 months to get back into playing. And it took me a year and a half then to get back in the first team and everything.
By the time you come back, I think Alan Ashman had been sacked. And yeah. He's been replaced by former West Brom player Don Howe. And this heralds probably one of your trickiest periods at West Brom, certainly in the early days. And Don Howe brings in the likes of Willie Johnston from Rangers, who will turn out to be a brilliant signing for the club. Ali Brown, another one, comes in from Leicester. Bobby Gould comes in from Arsenal as a player coach. The club finish 16th in Howe's first season, which is only a marginal improvement on Alan Ashman's last season. But there are all sorts of things going on. Bobby Hope, the Scottish midfielder, long-time Albion player, was sold, still only 29. Why were Albion having such a hard time adapting to the new management?
No disrespect to Don Howe, but as a manager, he was making me do and Bobby Hope do and Jeff Astle do a lot of things that we couldn't do. And because he was one of the young, new, teachers in the game, and he was trying to make us do things that we couldn't do. And it showed in the games where he was trying to make Bobby Hope tackle. Well, Bobby's not a tackler. Bobby would get close to people, but then he'd win the ball, and his passing was absolutely brilliant. Big Jeff. Jeff wasn't somebody who got to be running down channels, because that's not his game. And that's what he was trying to do. He was trying to make me go too tight to players. And I'm going, if I go too tight, the ball goes over my head. They'll beat me for my pace. And he kept saying to me, you've got to go tight. And every time I went tight, anybody would be watching us, said, no, I'll hit the ball over the head. They'll beat us for pace. And all these little things that we were saying to him, he would just, no, this is how we do it. You can't do it, out. And of course, we all couldn't do it, what he wanted us to do. And then we were all dropped. Bomber was dropped as well, because he was wanting Bomber to do certain things. And it was sad to see a team, and like, again, he brought Willie Johnston in, and to this day, you can have, if Dave was still alive, Dave Matthews, I said to Dave, put Willie beside me. He's my hero. He's a Rangers player. Please put him in the dressing room, put him beside me. I used to get his boots for him. I used to go out and sit and say, Alan, you're in the team the same as me, Willie. You're my hero. And he's going, no, you're in the team the same as me. You're exactly the same as me. And I'm going, Willie, I wish I could be the same as you. I says, because you are a hero. And things like that, that's where Willie was brilliant. He just encouraged you and keep you going. But that time with under Don Howe, when you say that under managers, if you lose a dressing room, you lose everything. He lost the dressing room. It just showed you that when we were training at Spring Road, you'd turn up at 9:45 for 10 o'clock training. Training would finish, everybody would just leave. And that was the difference. When Alan Ashman was here, we'd stop on things on the pitch. You'd try more things in the dressing room. You'd stay, you'd laugh, you'd giggle. You'd turn up at 9:30 in the morning to have a laugh with all the lads before training started. And under that year, you could see the whole thing had gone backwards big time. And then, of course, Giles, he come and he changed it completely back again. This is where I talk about managers. Everybody will say managers are great. Managers are only good for a player if he picks you. It's a horrible thing to say. But I know Don Howe made Gordon Nisbet. Like, Gordon Nisbet was going nowhere. He made him from a goalkeeper to a right back and got him going. And if you've got a manager that picks you, you think he's good. If you've got a manager that doesn't pick you, well, he's not a good manager, is he? That's how you look. And that's why I'll say to a lot of people, a manager's crap, but it's only because it didn't pick that person.
It is, though, in the Don Howe era, I think it's 71, 72, after recovering from your broken leg, that's arguably your breakthrough season and the beginning of what is a 10-year centre-back partnership with John Wiley, one of the great centre-back partnerships of English football of the last 40, 50 years. Why did you two work so well together, and how long did it take for that pairing to come into its own?
Well, it was quite funny. They signed John when I broke my leg, so I hated him. So when I come back from Scotland, I used to look at him, you know, so-and-so. But the biggest thing was John was Mr. Perfect. He was absolutely brilliant. He wouldn't go out drinking with the lads. He'd have one pint, two pint, he'd go home. He'd have a laugh with us, but he would be never one of the lads that we'd be going out to 3, 4 o'clock in the morning to nightclubs or anything, where I was a bit of a lad and we'd be go out drinking. But people used to say to me, you and John must do everything together. I said, no. Me and John are good pals. I says, but the minute we walk on that pitch, we just know what each other's going to do. We didn't ever work together and do anything extra. We just knew from the minute we started playing together, we just knew what each other was going to do. And it was brilliant. It was brilliant. And the two of us would look at each other at the start after about 10 minutes. It's got to be a hard one today, isn't it? or this is going to be a good one. And we just knew and we looked after each other all the way through. And John was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. We still talk to each other now. We're just saying, like, how brilliant it all was. Like, we're second, third in the old First Division, and yet none of us were. He was never picked for an England squad, and I was never picked for a Scottish squad. And, like, you think, we must have been picked for something to do something, but we never got anything. And, like, the big thing for me at that time, 78 World Cup, Argentina, Willie's picked for it, Ali McLeod's watching all the games that Willie's playing, and Willie's telling me he thinks you're doing brilliant. He thinks you're doing absolutely brilliant. And then when they used to pick a squad of 40, wasn't it? And then they knocked it down to 22. I never even got in the 40. And then you were looking at players from Raith Rovers, Cowden Beef. Now I'm thinking, we were second in the first division at the time. And I didn't even get a mention.
I think you mentioned that originally the provisional squad for the Scotland 78 World Cup squad, it was actually 80 players, which I found staggering. And then it was cut to 40, but you weren't even in the 80, which is even more ridiculous.
Yeah. And yet, every time Ali McLeod come to the games, it was one of those things that, and Willie used to say, bloody hell, I've done well, I've had a good going to that. I said, he must be looking now, he must be looking at something. And Willie kind of said to me, he keeps on mentioning you every game. He says, how great you've done. I says, well, you might keep mentioning it, but can you tell me to write my name down somewhere? But never did. And that's the one thing I look back, that for John and myself, even if we had just got into one squad and got into a team, one game, it would have been fantastic.
Before we come to West Brom's relegation under Don Howe, Arsenal obviously fancied you as a player because they tracked you as a schoolboy and they come in for you in October 72. I think Don Howe was trying to bring in Frank McClintock You would go to London. I think you mentioned earlier in your autobiography that one of the reasons you weren't interested in Arsenal or Spurs was because you weren't keen on living in London. By 72, how would you have felt if that Arsenal move had come off?
Well, again, the same scout that was when I was 15, my dad knew him because we used to play football together. My dad knew him. And my dad phoned me up and he says, by the way, next week I think you're going to Arsenal. And I've gone, but Dad, I don't want to go. He says, well, I think you'll be going to Arsenal because I think Don Howe's getting you out, and they're buying Frank McClintock. He says, so if you stop at West Brom, you won't be in the team or anything. He says, so it's probably something that you've got to do. So he phoned me up on the Thursday morning, and he says, Ali, it's got to happen today, but you can't tell anybody it's got to happen today. So I goes into training, does all the training, does everything. Training finishes. I'm waiting in the dressing room. I then do a little bit extra on the pitch. I come back in. I'm still waiting in the dressing room. I'm thinking, what's got to happen? What's happening? Phone my dad up. My dad says, oh, I think it's fallen through. And I went, yes, you beauty. And he went, you what? I says, I didn't want to go, Dad. I said, London frightens me. And he says, by all accounts, McClintock, they couldn't agree terms or something. And that's when he went to QPR, didn't he?
Was West Brom's relegation in the 72-73 season inevitable?
Yes. Like, I was in and out of the team probably for the last 4 months, I didn't play. And I was in the reserves and doing everything. And the one thing that just kept me going was, when I'm playing away in the reserves, the teams that you were playing, how many of their coaches had come to me and would say to me, Howard, why are you not in the first team? And I don't know how many people said that. But that kept me going. And that just kept me going and kept me going. And of course, Don Howe got the sack. And the last three games, I played the last three games because they brought us back in then. And I just thought, well, how can somebody do that? So all that close season, I trained every day. And because I used to go back to Scotland for the 10 weeks, 96, and I said to my dad, I'm training every day. So I trained, and my dad says, don't. I said, no, I've got to train every day, Dad. So when this new manager comes, whoever it is, I'm going to be fit. And I trained all the way through. And of course, Jowsey comes at the team, and he pulls me after 2 weeks, and he said to me, why didn't you get the first team? I went, I don't know, Don. I just didn't like me, I don't think. He said, well, I'm telling you now, you're in my team. Well, I'm in the team. He says, yes, you're in the team. So, and this is the funniest thing now. This stuck with me all through my life. Well, the first game was on the Saturday, and on the Thursday, we're in Spring Road, and Jowsey gets us all in the big room together. And he says, right, lads, this is how this season's going to be. And he says, Ali, you're a defender. Your job, win the ball. If you could pass the ball, you'd be a midfielder. And you're looking, you're thinking, Jesus Christ. And he goes, nah, give it to a midfielder. If I could score goals, I'd be a centre-forward. Well, I can't, so I've got to make the goals. And then we do all the balls in the box and centre-forwards and whatever, score the goals. If we all do our jobs, it makes this life so much easier. And then they come out with this one saying that I still talk to him today about it, which is, he come out and said, just remember, on a Saturday, there'll be two or three of us not playing well. This is the biggest thing he says. Don't bollock them. Help them, because that could be you. Now, opposite to Don Howe used to say, if he's not playing well, get down his throat. Tell him. Well, Jelsey says, help them. And then that went into everybody's head, and you could feel the camaraderie and the team spirit. We went from the bottom to the top, and it was brilliant. And he knew that on a Saturday, we'd all fight and kill for each other. And it's like that big thing is, that might be you that's not playing well.
Johnny Giles had come in for the 75-76 season, and he's come in as player-manager and rightly regarded as one of the greatest midfielders that we've seen in English football. He was still playing at the time for West Brom as well, wasn't he, in that first season in the second division?
He was unbelievable. He'd want the ball. Even if somebody was marking him, he'd say, even if somebody's marking me, give me the ball. And we'd give him the ball. He'd just drop his shoulder and he'd ping it out to Willie. Drop his shoulder, ping it out to Paddy Mulligan. His passing and his tackles and everything, brilliant. And he said, and he again brought it all in, team spirit is the most important part of any football. And he says, he's Leeds lads, that's why we were how we were. If somebody kicks you, somebody else kicks them back. And that was a bit that we all learned from Jersey. And he said, if we all do our jobs, this is how good football is. And then in the coaching-wise, he used to walk through things. He used to get some training and walk through how he wanted us to do it. And like you think, how easy and how good is this? And everything he did, I was gutted when he left. Because John come, and I never missed a game. And John, I never missed a game in his 2 years he was there. And I was praying he'd stay for another year, 2 years, 3 years. And it was sad for him to go.
He got West Brom up in his first season, 75-76. Yeah. You clinched promotion at Oldham. The following season, you're back in Division One. You finish a very credible seventh. You got Brian Robson.
Yeah.
Brian Robson has by now established himself in the side. Derek Statham, the gifted left back, he gets a run in the team. Len Cantello and Tony Brown, yourself, players that had struggled under Don Howe are all playing really well now. And then, as you just said there, Johnny Giles resigns. Did you see that one coming?
No. It was West Brom at the time were a club that were very family orientated, and it was afterwards that you hear that John wanted to do so many things that they didn't want to do. So you can see why they didn't go any bigger or better. But it was sad for us as players to see him go, because he was absolutely brilliant in how he talked to you. And even if you had a bad game, he'd pull you aside and he'd say, right, come on, this is what you've got to do. And again, the biggest thing for me, this just sums him up. When we got beat 7, was it at Ipswich? We got beat 7. John Osborne was injured, and he had injured his arm and everything. After the game, he just said to himself, right, get on the bus. He got on the bus, stop at a pub. We stopped at a pub, got a few beers. He then got beers on the coach, and he says, on the way back, when we landed, he says, right, this game's forgotten. We come into training Monday morning, and we do it right. This is never mentioned again. It was never mentioned again. And again, from that game, we went on a great run again, because he knew it was a bad day. It was one day off. Forget about it. Just make sure you get on to the next.
The following season is a strange one. Ronnie Allen, the former West Brom player, he takes over as manager. He's gone by Christmas to take over as Saudi Arabia manager. John Wiley, who's still only 30, then takes over as caretaker manager briefly. The club have been on this fantastic two-season upward trajectory. How close did that period come to derailing everything?
Big time. You could see, because Ronnie Allen come in and then he tried to change too many things. He was trying to do the same thing as what Don Howe was doing. But we were lucky that he went, and it was Ron, Big Ron that came. So we were lucky that Big Ron came then. And then we were sad that when Big Ron left, then that's when you could see the club falling down completely. Because Big Ron goes, he takes Brian with him. Then just beforehand, Len Cantello goes to Bolton. We lost a lot of really good players at that time. And you could see that we were never going to replace them. And that's when the club went back.
Still to come on When Shorts Were Short.
And he wouldn't pick me for anything. He'd pick me in some third teams, reserve games. He'd pick me, play me in some, not play me in others. And he just never talked to me once. I went to his office almost about 10 times, knocked the door, wouldn't let me in. Would never talk to me.
Half time, please do remember to rate, review and subscribe to When Shorts Were Short on your go-to podcast platform. Please share the links too on social media if you do enjoy the show. And by all means, let your pals know. Word of mouth, we are of that generation who remember the world before the internet. These are the ways a tiny podcast like this can survive and grow. Thank you to everyone who does support the show. A special hello to Keith Giles this week for his feedback and thoughts on the podcast. Some housekeeping following on from the Classic Kits episode with Dave Bowler a couple of weeks back. A slight error on my part, which at my peak wouldn't have happened. I'm not at the level I used to be at with anything right now. The focus just isn't there. Listener Ian Wallbank had posted his three kit selections on the Facebook page, and one of them was the classic Denmark 86 Hummel World Cup strip, the half and half, which a year later in English football had been replicated by Villa, Coventry and Southampton. Coventry's one for me was especially beautiful. And I erroneously said on the last episode that Denmark's had been preceded by a year by the Tottenham 85-87 home strip when Spurs switched to Hummel and an all-white kit. They actually only ever wear all-white in the top flight when Leeds are not in the top division, by the way. That is a historical fact. You can check that out. And the Hummel kit, the Hummel Spurs kit, this was in the summer of 85 when Spurs spent big on Chris Waddle and Paul Allen. They might have been the first English club to bring in Hummel. I can't be sure of that, but I think they were. And of course, Tottenham also had some investment in the company in the late 80s, early 90s, which ultimately almost brought about their financial implosion in 91. But of course, that kit, and I know this, so why did I get this wrong? It wasn't a half and half, at least not in the vein of the Denmark, Villa, Coventry and Southampton kits. It was a half and half, but it was a horizontal divide rather than the vertical split of the Danish version. I think I've got that right. Tottenham fan Lee, he will probably be able to put me right on that. Back to your classic strip selections. Graham Baldy Man Simpson posted, I can't remember if I read this one out a couple of weeks back, his selections were West Germany 1974 home. Of course, they've now done away with Adidas, who I think they were with since the 54 World Cup, or perhaps longer. I think it was 54. So they were with Adidas for about 70 years. I think they've now switched to Nike, or if I want to be fashionable, Nike. The USSR 1988 red home kit, I think it was a similar design, wasn't it, to the Dutch kit, if I remember rightly. And Graham has also gone for the early 80s Southampton away, the two-tone blue. I had said a couple of weeks back I wasn't a fan of the mid-80s Patrick strips that Southampton and Birmingham wore, but the early Patrick strips, you know, the Swansea strip, the Southampton strip, both home and away, I was a big fan of those strips. The away kit that Graham mentions, that was certainly a classic. Southampton wore that for five seasons from 1980 to 85. And that is how classic kits become classic. They can be closely identified and linked to particular eras, unlike these days when strips disappear after a single season. The away kits are worn unnecessarily and they disappear after barely getting into double figures in terms of appearances. You cannot have classic kits like that. There was another post too from Chrissy Brand in the Facebook group, but I can't see it now. And I've tried accessing it on both my PC and my phone and the comment has just disappeared, or I'm not being allowed to see all the comments. If you're listening, if you are part of the When Shorts Were Short Facebook group, and if you want to join it, it is When Shorts Were Short 2023. It's now up to 85 members. I don't know if they're all listeners. Maybe they're not even aware that there is a show, actually. That wouldn't surprise me. But obviously some of them are aware, but I don't think all 85 are. But if you are listening to this and you're able to access Chrissy's post, if it is still up there, because I went back to her and asked her to specify the specific eras of the strips that she had gone with, and she did so. But I can't see them now. But if you're able to see them, please screenshot them for me, post them on the Facebook group or on the show's Twitter so I can take a look, and hopefully on the next episode I can read out Chrissy's selections. Right, let's get back to the second half of this week's interview with Alistair Robertson. Let's just look at the Ron Atkinson era first. He arrives in January 78, and unlike Ronnie Allen, he doesn't change much. He steers the club to a sixth place finish. And there's the famous 78 FA Cup semi-final against Ipswich, which was at Highbury. And Ipswich's brilliant team will emerge on the back of that year's FA Cup triumph. But in the league, unusually for them under Bobby Robson, they were actually struggling that season. They only stay up. It's actually West Brom who are the favourites going into that game. Why did it go so wrong for West Brom on the day?
I wish I could put a figure on it. But we actually all said we just never turned up for that day. It wasn't just one bad player. Nobody played well at all. And of course, John cracks his head and cuts his head. And all the little things that could go wrong were going wrong. And all the chances that we did get, we missed. And they only had a couple of chances and scored. And that's how football goes. And it was, again, Big Ron got Bill Shankly to come with us. Bill Shankly was on the bus with us. He sat beside me and he just says, just remember, this game is no different. And it's true, it should be no different of a game. You go out and play the same at this game as if you play in any other game. But the three semi-finals that we got to, we just didn't turn up in each one of them. We didn't play well in any of the games. Whether we were favourites to win or whether we just... I didn't do anything different to what I would have done in any other games, but we just didn't play at all. We did not play at all.
There was a passage in the book where you mentioned that I think there was a two or three games in that 77-78 season towards the end of that season where the young Brian Robson was your centre-back partner because John Wiley was out injured. And that reminded me that even at United under Ron Atkinson, when they had injury problems, and I think in Ferguson's early days as manager, Robson would occasionally still play that centre-back role. He was such a complete player that he could play it. But you say that by then it was clear he was becoming too great a midfielder to be considered for the centre-back slot on a permanent basis.
Yes. When Brian was brilliant at tackling, heading, getting the ball, passing it. But what his biggest asset was, he'd win the ball, give it wide, the ball would go in the box and he'd be in the box heading it. And his fitness was incredible. He could run all day. And that was a great thing about. And I think if they had played him at the back, it would have ruined so much of a game for him because he made things happen. He was brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
Before we touch on the memorable 78-79 season on the pitch, one of Albion's best players has his career at the Hawthorns come to an end following his failed drugs test at the Argentina World Cup. How difficult was it for you to see what happened to Willie Johnston? Was there any way he could have continued at West Brom that season? Because I think he was banned from playing in Europe, wasn't he? He couldn't play in the UEFA Cup that season.
Again, this was, everybody thought Willie was taking drugs. He was taking the same as what a lot of most of other players were taking. But for that thing in Argentina, it was one tiny little bit of that drug that was shouldn't have been there and he shouldn't have taken it. But it wasn't something going to make you big and do anything. It was something just to calm you down. And that Willie had taken them all his life. Man City players took them. How many players you then found out after in the English league had taken those pills. See, that was something with me again. I would never take any pills. I'm so old-fashioned. I'd get the painkillers, I'd take the two after the game, and then they'd say, right, take the pills. I would never, when I went back to my digs, I'd go back home, they'd be in the cupboard, I would never take them. And I would never take anything like that unless it was really bad. And that's where a lot of the lads would take these pills to quiet me down, or I just didn't believe in them. And I think Willie was just picked out of something that really shouldn't have happened.
The 78-79 campaign, though, that is the one that you don't have to be a West Brom fan to remember what West Brom did that season. Any fan of football fan of my generation will remember that West Brom team. And, you know, there's the famous 5-3 win at Old Trafford. And we'll find, I know that game's on YouTube, and we'll also try and find your debut against United to stick in the show notes when this episode goes out. So the 5-3 win at Old Trafford was, I think, the final game of 78 for both sides. It was just before New Year's Eve. I think you've got Cyril Regis is now established as the club's centre forward. Brendan Batson has followed the manager from Cambridge at right back. On the left wing, you've got the brilliant Laurie Cunningham, and you know, you make no bones about it, how highly you rated Laurie Cunningham. As a boy, I was lucky enough to watch him play at Real Madrid, and you know, the fans out there loved him while he was at his best. You knock Valencia out of the UEFA Cup in the third round, which is no mean feat, and they were among the favourites that year. They've got Mario Kempes, who's just been the World Cup's top scorer in 78. You win 3-1 on aggregate. Were you surprised by that, or did it just simply confirm what a good side West Brom were now?
I still believe that season, Laurie Cunningham was the best player in England. That season, he was incredible. You know how good he was, pace and everything, but how many players, he would just ride the tackle. He'd never fall over. He'd not be like the players nowadays that would fall over and think they're dead. He'd just ride the tackle, get on with it. He was incredible. And you can see, against when we played in Spain, he was out this world, and that's why you can see Real Madrid buying him, because those games out there, he played, tore the teams apart, and he made Kempes look an average player. Will, honestly, Laurie was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. I wish we could have kept him for another two or three seasons as well. That would have made us do things as well. If we could have kept Laurie, Brian Robson, Cyril, all those players, Derek Stadham, all those players, kept them for another three or four seasons together, that'd been great.
We'll come to the exit of Cunningham and Cantello in 79 in a moment, because your views on that are really interesting and gave me a different perspective. Just before that, West Brom finished third in 78-79, a point behind reigning league champions Forest, who were about to win the first of their two European Cups. And Liverpool win the league that season, and they are, of course, the reigning European Cup holders. Much is made of that winter's big freeze costing West Brom the title. Without the big freeze, could West Brom have won the league that year? Or has that been overplayed? And the reality is that you had a brilliant season, and it needs to be put in context. You finished behind two of the greatest club teams this country has ever seen. Where do you stand on that?
I think you've got the end of the season, we finished third. That's how it is. We just wish that, it's like you said, at that time we were playing, every one of us was playing out of skins. And we did not be frightened to go anywhere and win. We would not have been frightened to win. And of course, we then had, was it four games off? Liverpool had played all the games. And then our first game was back, was at Liverpool, and they beat us. And you think, but we hadn't played. If we hadn't stopped playing, we would have been up there fighting with Liverpool to the last day, the last game. We would have been. I actually look back, and you would have hoped we would have gone on and won the league that year. We were good enough to do it. And just like you say, and that seems to have happened, like I said earlier, in my career, something's always come and done something that's stopped us win something.
Right. This is something I found really interesting, your point of view here, because you mentioned earlier that when Ron Atkinson leaves in the summer of 81 to take the United job, that that's when it really starts to fall apart at West Brom, which, you know, it was my own view before reading your book. But you mentioned that the summer of 79, Real Madrid come in for Laurie Cunningham. Okay, that's not that surprising given how Laurie Cunningham was playing. But Len Cantello makes a really strange move to Bolton, given where West Brom are as a force in English football. And looking at it, West Brom do remain very strong under Ron Atkinson. You finish fourth in 81, but you put forward the view that the sales of Laurie Cunningham and Len Cantello set the club back, despite Peter Barnes arriving from Manchester City. He was an England regular at the time, which Laurie Cunningham wasn't. Gary Owen has also come in from Manchester City. And I think Cyril Regis, the late Cyril Regis, says the same in his foreword to your book. He also mentions the departures in 79. So without those two players leaving, could West Brom have done more in what was left of the Ron Atkinson era?
Yes. Len Cantello was unbelievable. That Len would sit and do all the hard work, the same as Pop, but the two of them as a partnership were incredible, were incredible. And Lenny, I don't think, was given enough accolades because people look, well, he didn't get in the box, he didn't do what Brian did, but he just made sure Brian could do all those things, because he would cover for him and do all the bits when we defend him. And as defenders, having Lenny in front of you was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And actually, if we could have kept him and Laurie for another 2 years, don't know what could have happened. And kept Big Ron as well. We kept it all together. It could have been a great 2-3 years.
In that late 70s period, John Gregg, the Rangers manager, makes an inquiry for you. Why did the move fall away? And is that a move that you would have made given your love for Rangers?
Bobby Hope phones me up and goes, just been talking to John Gregg. He wants to buy you. I mean, you're joking. He went, no, he wants to buy you. Well, would you believe at the time, my dad was dying of cancer. And I've gone, oh, please, get him to buy me so my dad can see me play for Rangers. That will make me feel so great. All of a sudden, he's seen me play for the Rangers. So I never say that thing to anybody, didn't say nothing, and Bobby comes back to me. won't let me go, won't let me go. I says, you what? He says, he won't let you go. I think he's offered 375 grand, which was a fortune. And he says, he won't let you go. So I actually went into Big Ron, and I says to Ron, please, as a friend, I says, I wouldn't go unless my dad's dying. I says, if my dad wasn't dying of cancer, I would not go. I says, but he's dying of cancer, he's got a year to live, if that. Can I just go to Rangers and let him see me play for Rangers? And he went, if they pay the right money, Ali, yes, you can. I says, they've offered you a fortune. Not enough. And that's how it was finished, and he just never went anywhere from that. And the only thing for me that I was thinking, that if I'd gone to Rangers, I might have got a Scotland's cap as well. That was the one thing I kept on thinking. But it never happened, so you just can't look at it, can you? But I was just so sad for my dad. It would have made him feel incredible that he'd seen me play for Rangers and be one of the Rangers players.
You stay on at West Brom, and Ron Atkinson moves to United in that summer of 81, and that effectively signals the end of West Brom as a major force in English football. And I know that they've been in the Premier League for a number of seasons over the last 20 years, but they've never been the same club they were up to that point of 81, where they were, you know, one of the country's foremost clubs. You lose Remy Moses, you lose Brian Robson. Peter Barnes leaves for Leeds in a huge deal, which, from what you write about him, for all his talent, he could be somewhat frustrating. And given Leeds paid serious money for him, it looks like West Brom got the better end of the deal there. Tony Brown has gone. How hard was it for long-serving players such as yourself to see the club's ambition just fall away after this?
They bought good players, like your Peter Barnes, your Gary Oates. They were all good players, but no disrespect to them, they weren't as good as the players that had left. And that is the one thing you look and you could see that Albion were not the club to go and spend big money to get all the big players. They'll get players that they can afford. And that's how the club was. And that's what you do, and that's how you get on with it. But we were just so lucky at the time to have bought Cyril for, what was it, 10 grand, 8 grand, to get Willie Johnston, to get Laurie Cunningham for more or less nothing, to get Brian Robson through the books, Lincoln Taylor through, all those types of players, myself, John Wilde, they didn't play a lot for, Brendan, they didn't play a lot for, Derek Statham was another one coming through as a kid. And we had just had a great time at West Brom, that was happening. But it just all seemed, you could see it falling away. And as it happened, 3 years later, it did fall away completely.
You mentioned another major factor that was something I didn't know about that perhaps played a part in West Brom's decline in the early 80s. There was Tony Silk, who was earmarked to be the next West Brom chairman after Bert Millerchip. He's a businessman promising to invest money in the club, but he and his wife were tragically killed when their private plane crashed in France in September 80. What can you tell us about Tony Silk, and would his investment in the club have helped West Brom navigate those choppy post-Atkinson waters in better fashion?
Probably, yes. Mr. Silk was a great director, absolutely one of fantastic. He'd actually be one of the directors who would come and actually talk to us. And his sons would come and talk to us. We'd all sit there talking. We'd be drinking in the pub, and he'd come and sit with us and drink with us and laugh with us. Where normally directors would be put themselves up there, they're way above us, that don't mix with us. But Mr. Silk was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And he'd come and ask you, is there any problems? No. And I got on great with him. And I was hoping that when he would be made chairman, I know that the club would have done well. But of course, what happened was sickening, that him and his wife got killed in the airplane crash.
Ronnie Allen makes a surprising return as manager to succeed Ron Atkinson. Tell us about the story that Allen got the job by mistake in 81. Again, that's something I'd never heard.
Yeah, it was the wrong Ronnie. we heard about it, but we couldn't believe that it was right. And like you're thinking, but he come back in, and again, he tried to change too many things, and it's quite funny. He dropped me and Bomber the last time, and he dropped me and Bomber again this time. And it was something that we weren't all together with him. But he come in, And he just, for me, I didn't think he was a good manager because he didn't pick me. And that's what I was saying earlier. If he picked me, I would probably say he was a good manager. But he didn't pick me, and the training went down, everything was wrong, and he didn't see too many things that were happening. Like, who was coach? Kelly was coach. And what Kelly was doing, they would go down and do training. He'd make me and John Wilde go and kick the ball to each other. He wouldn't involve us with the training. And we'd be, the minute Ron Allen or Ron Wiley would come round the corner, he'd fetch us back in. And it was all, you could see everything in the background's all not right. And that was sad to see all. Because when we had Big Ron, when we had Jowsy, you knew exactly where everybody was, and everybody knew the jobs, and everybody knew exactly what you had to do. And everyone trusted each other all the way through. And you could see the trust going. And that, to me, is the biggest thing. Biggest thing.
Was it true that the West Brom secretary was meant to call Alan Mullery rather than Ronnie Allen?
Ronnie Allen, yes.
That's extraordinary.
And when he cut the call, and then when he says, yes, he's took the job, and of course, then he comes. This is what we're getting told. We didn't know, but we got told the same as what you just said there. Now, maybe if it was Alan Mullery coming and he came in, he could have changed the whole thing around, couldn't he? It's something we'll never know.
The club finished 17th in 81-82, a huge fall from fourth the previous season. And as mentioned earlier, as you touched on, you get to two more semi-finals in the League Cup and the FA Cup that season. Spurs edge you out of the League Cup, 1-0 on aggregate. QPR, they're a strong second division side that year. They beat you in the FA Cup semis. But how do you compare these semi-final losses to the 78 defeat? Because 78 was peak West Brom. That was a game you could argue that you should have won. By 82, you were a diminished force, and maybe the thinking was, well, you've done really well to get there.
All those games, we still should have won. Like Spurs, for whatever reason, we always did well against Spurs. But in that semi-final, we were absolutely abysmal. We didn't turn up. Then again, against QPR, it was quite funny. I didn't ever watch the game until about 3 years ago, 4 years ago. I would never watch it. But when I did watch it, and you see it from the bits that it was on the telly, we were absolutely all over the place. We were all over. And you can't believe that how we all were, but and how we played. We were not as a team. But again, we trained all the way up to the game. And then on the Saturday morning, he tells us the team, and he changes the team from what we had trained all through the week. He puts Martin Bennett in midfield instead of Gary Owen. But all week we'd been training on the field how we've got to do everything, and yet he changes it on the Saturday morning. Why on earth did he change it?
There's not much improvement when Ron Wiley comes in ahead of the 82-83 season. And during this period, there are many changes on the playing side of things. I think John Wiley returns to Peterborough as player manager. I think you become captain. Ken McNaught comes in for John Wiley. Martin Bennett, who you've mentioned, the young centre-back, he's having injury problems. Brendan Batson has an injury that will eventually force him to retire. Tony Morley has come in from Villa. You've got two European Cup winners in your ranks now, but a lot of departures. Was the team ever going in the right direction under Ron Wiley?
No. He comes in. This is the sad. This is where I still can't believe it. He comes in, gets me in his office. Right, I'm going to make you captain. I'm going to give you a rise in your wages. I'm going to do this. I says, well, let me think about it. Next day, he buys Ken McNaught. And I've gone back in his office. Well, why you bought Ken McNaught? Well, he's got to play centre-half instead of you. He just says, you're going to make me captain. Yeah, you'll be captain, but you're not playing. And I just said to him, well, you can stick your contract where the monkey stuck its nuts. And I just walked out. And you think to yourself, how can a manager tell you that one day and change completely the next? And that, to me, again, just shows you how the club were working. Not right at all. Not right at all.
Johnny Giles returns as manager in early 84. His first game is the FA Cup fifth round tie at home to Plymouth, and Plymouth in the third division grab a famous win. Johnny Giles' second spell doesn't quite work out, though there is a very promising start to the 84-85 season. The first half of that campaign, West Brom are looking pretty strong. Why did it not quite work out for Giles in his second spell? Had he simply been away from the English game for too long? Because for every brilliant Steve Hunt signing, there's a player maybe who's on the wrong side of the curve, like Jerry Armstrong, who's nearing the end of his career. There's Carl Valentine, who may not even have been a first division standard. How do you see that second Johnny Giles spell?
Johnny come in and I was out as well. I was out. I'd got a thigh problem. I'd just had a thigh operation, so I was out for about 6 months. And he was desperate to get me fit to get in the team. And he kept on saying, well, this is not good enough, he's not good enough, this is not good enough. And again, he was trying to get players in who he knew, but it's like you say, the standard that he was getting in were not nowhere near the standard that to make us any better, they wouldn't have made us any better. And John could see it, and that's why he just walked away. He could see it himself. Because he kept on saying to me, you need to play, you need to play. And I said, John, I can't play it. And I actually played a few games and I shouldn't have played because I wasn't 100% fit. But I only played it for John. And the whole club at the time, again, you could see it wasn't right. And of course, he saw it himself and he packed up after about 6 months.
Nobby Styles takes over briefly. In February 86, Ron Saunders arrives. West Brom are in the bottom three. These were your final months with the club. You'd been at the Hawthorns for 18 years. The club's about to be relegated. You're exiled from the team. The manager doesn't want you there. A very sad way for your time at the club to end.
Yeah, that for me was the Saunders comes in. I won't call him Ron Saunders, I'll call him Saunders. Saunders comes in. He puts the first team up. And like I say, I had just come back from this injuries and I'm just starting to get a little bit fit. And he puts the first team sheet up. There's about 20-odd players on the team sheet. And I went to George, right? I says, George, I'm not on the team sheet, man. I know he doesn't want you. He doesn't want you. He doesn't want you there. And he says, he doesn't want you to come to the game either. If you come to the game, you won't get in the players' room. And I went, you what? He says, I'm telling you that. He doesn't want you at the game. So I went home to Scotland. Come back on the Monday morning. I says, right, I'm going to prove him wrong. So I trained 10 times harder. But so when training started the Monday morning, first team went up, reserves went up. And I went, to George, where am I training? You train on your own. I then had to train on my own. And he wouldn't pick me for anything. He'd pick me in some third teams, reserve games. He'd pick me, play me in some, not play me in others. And he just never talked to me once. I went to his office almost about 10 times, knocked the door, wouldn't let me in. Would never talk to me. The start the following season, again, I says, I'm going to be, I've trained all the way through and turns up for training again, right, pre-season training. Again, I'm left out everywhere. And then there's about 10 of us at the time out. Tony Gordon, Imre Varadi, Garth Crooks, Tony Grealish, Stevie Hunt, there's about 8 of us all playing in the reserves. And we went to this game and at the end of the game, Garth Crooks and Imre Varadi were taken out at half-time and they just went home. At the end of the game, the coach started slaughtering those two lads. And I said to him, I said, excuse me, I says, those two lads are not even here. We've got 8 or 9 young lads here, 16, 17-year-olds, that have done brilliant today. Shouldn't we be telling them how good they are and get Imre Varadi and Garth Crooks on Monday morning and give them the biggest rollicking of their life when we go to training? Don't start telling me what to do. I said, I'm not telling you what to do. I said, I'm just saying to you, these lads here, and of course, that's when I turned up for training on the Monday morning, and Dave Matthews says, where are you getting transferred to? I don't know, why? He says, well, there's all your kit. And that was me out the door. And it was quite funny on the Saturday, on the Sunday as well. Brian Whitehead used to be there, Brian Whitehead. Clive Whitehead used to phone me up on every Sunday and tell me about all the games because he got made captain. And he used to be able to talk the double of Ron Saunders. You wouldn't know any difference. So anyway, after this game, we all went out in the town. I get back home rather merry. Wakes up in the morning, the missus goes, Saunders is on the phone for you. So I've picked up the phone. Now I'm thinking it's Clive Whitehead. And I went, oh, sod off. And all I heard them say was 9:30. And I thought, so I phoned Clive up in the afternoon. go on then, what were you on about? He went, what? I said, you phoned me this morning. He went, I haven't phoned you. I said, you had your Saunders voice on. Come on. He says, Ali, I'm telling you now, I didn't phone you. And I thought, Christ. So that's why I turned up at 9:30. And he was just sad. He just kicked me out the door. And I remember, I said, before I do anything, I phoned Brendan at the PFA. And I said, Brendan, where to go? Do I still got 2 years contract?
This is Brendan Batson, isn't it? He's now at the PFA.
Yes, PFA, yeah. So Brendan, I says to Brendan, says, they've just told me the parents, well, if that's the case, you can't do a thing. Now, the only thing for me was, and this is where I went back to the directors and everything, I says, now, I've played with you for 18 years. If it was a bad professional, I'd say, yes, kick me out. I says, but that's the last thing you can say about me. Why don't you just let me be there, find me a club? Don't just kick me out the door. Why don't you just, so I can train with you, do everything, then find me a club? He doesn't want you to do that. I went, no, but you as a club, and I've played for you for 18 years, surely that must be something. And that was the one thing that when I left, and I like to be fair, I met the lads after and everything, even though they were saying they can't believe what's happened, but that made me feel so badly about the Albion at the time. And I just, forget the manager, I played for you for 18 years and I gave my life for you. Cost them no money at all, didn't get paid huge amounts of money, but for me, it's just at the end, they gave it all away for them. Now, Mr. Silk was there, that wouldn't happen.
You joined Wolves that summer of 86 as Brian Little's player coach. The English game has rarely seen a fall as dramatic as Wolves' decline in the mid-80s, where they went from, I think, the First Division to Division Four in just three seasons. What shape was the club in when you signed? Because Brian Little wasn't around for too long after you turned up as his player coach, was he?
No. See, I went because of Brian, nobody else. Because I actually said to him, how can I come to Wolves? And I've played for West Brom for 18 years. He said, they're all young players. We just need an old to come in. So I said, go on then. I went the first day, I turned up. This is how badly the club was. They had no kit. They had nothing. So I turned up and I says, well, where's my kit? Have you brought any kit? I says, well, no. And he goes, you've not. So I had to drive back to West Brom to Dave Matthews. Dave, can you get me some kit? But I can't have any blue and white or anything. So you need any kit you've got that's not blue and white. So I got the kit. So starts training. After a week, I phones up Bobby Hope, and Bobby Hope was manager of Bromsgrove at the time. And I said to Bobby, I can't believe what I've done. I've signed for Wolves. There must be 20 players here who wouldn't even get in your side. They are no wonder they're bottom of the fourth division. And once we started training and once you started looking, and as it happened, you could see it starting to pick up a little bit that the players were actually becoming now a team rather than nothing. And of course, we went away from home on this Sunday. Comes back, I'm driving home, and Brian phones me up and says, I've just had to sack. I went, you what? They've just sacked me. I went, good God. So I turns up for training on the Monday morning. What do I do? I'm coach. Like, what do I do? Brian's not there anymore. What do I do? So we just trained. Then of course, a couple of days after, Graham Turner comes in. And that was the biggest thing that happened to Wolverhampton. He turned it completely. And to be fair to him, did a fantastic job.
Did you revert to just being a player under Graham Turner?
Yes. Because it's quite funny. We still laugh about it to this day. John Purdy, Mickey Holmes, David Barnes were all the lads in the dressing room. So when I then come in the dressing room, I says, well, and he says to me, oi, he says, you're not a player, you're a coach. He says, no, I'm a player now. You've got to earn your rights. I says, where's my peg? They put my peg in the toilet. So I had the undress the toilet for a week. And I says, oh, I'll do what you tell, don't worry. So I did it all. They said, all right, we can see you're one of us then. So I then got back in the dressing room. And then after a bit, doing all the bit, I remember going to Graham Turner and saying, Graham, I can't do this. He went, what's up? He says, you're hitting balls in the corners, you're doing this. I says, I've been brought up at West Brom. We play football, we do this. He says, Ali, these lads are in the fourth division. You had Brian Robson, Lincoln Taylor, Tony Brown, Bobby Hope, players to pass it to. Who have we got that can pass it? Get the ball in their end and I'll show you at training this works. I went, okay. So we every day at training, we started hitting the balls down the channels for Bully and Mochi. And the whole season changed. And after 4 weeks, I went back into his back at his dressing room and I said to him, Graham, I hold my hands up. I do apologise for going against it. I said, now you can see it happening. He says, yeah. And I says, well, as from today, I'm making you captain. Then I made you captain. And then from then on, we had a great season. Well, we just got beaten the playoffs. Because I was injured, as it happens. I couldn't play. We just got beaten the playoffs. But then we won the fourth division, the third division, got into the second, won the Shepherd Van. And it was brilliant. To see a club go from how it was to that was brilliant. And the only thing that I look back and I think to myself, if I could have only got there 2 years younger and got us into the first division, went from fourth, third, second, first, that would have been incredible. But to see a club that were, when we started, my first crowd was 2,000 something. And then by the end of that season, we got up to 20-odd thousand. The following season, we were back to 30,000. And to see a club rebuild itself, and a club so big as Wolves, to see it rebuild itself was brilliant. Then the horrible thing was, I remember saying to Saunders, now you're manager, you'll go third, you'll go all the way down, and I hope I get a club that passes you. Well, I was at Wolves when we went from the third to the into the second, and Albion went from the second to the third. And like you think, Jesus. But to see Albion then go that way, it was sad. But it was great to see Wolves, then the club changed so much. And to be part of that was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Another former West Brom player who was with you at Wolves, he never quite made the grade at Albion. That was Steve Bull, who you mentioned a few moments ago. How much work was required to transform him into such a phenomenal striker for Wolves? Because what he was doing in the late 80s, early 90s was just insane.
Yeah. Bully, when he come from the Albion, and I remember saying to Turner, I remember saying, once you come in, and I says, Bully will miss a lot of chances. But I must hold my hands up to Gary Pendry. Gary Pendry used to take him after training and make him go through one against one with a goalkeeper. And he says, don't blast the ball high, whack it at his legs. And Bully all of a sudden started whacking the ball at the goalkeeper's legs. And that first season he scored, was it 51 goals? Was it? Yeah, he just went from missing chances all the time to score on chance, and he was brilliant. And to see a lad come and do so good, because I started with him in the reserves, I was trying to pull him through in the reserves, and you could see he had the ability. And when they come, and little Tomo, brilliant, and then Robbie Dennison come as well, what a great four Albion lads. And to see us all play as a team, and we all knew how it had to be done. And Turner, Graham, to be fair to him, he just says, right, this is a formation. He talked to us the same as how Big Ron and Johnny Giles talked to him. And you could see the whole thing changing. And the dressing room, again, from nobody turning up to everybody, coming in at 9:30, staying there all day, all going up the pub together. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
You retired in 1990. You were almost 38, and Wolves had finished a respectable 10th that season in Division 2. You have very brief spells as a non-league manager with Worcester and Cheltenham. Why did those come to an end? And were you a manager long enough to know that it wasn't for you?
It wasn't for me. Everything I've said from the start. But when I was at Wolves, I applied for the Exeter job and got the Exeter job. And if I'd got that as a player manager, I'd already got Tony Greaves coming and Clive Whitehead coming. And I think I would have probably put Clive as manager and I would have been part of the players and whatever. I don't think I was ever going to be a good manager. I think I would have been a good number two to somebody, but I don't think I would have been a good manager. I did it because in our day, you couldn't retire. You didn't have enough money in the bank to retire, so you had to have a job. So when I applied for Worcester and Worcester gave me the job, we were actually doing all right, but then the person who was running it, it was broke, so we had to sell all the players. Then they couldn't afford my wages, so I had to walk out because they couldn't afford to pay me. And then I signed for Cheltenham. Same thing happened again. They got bought out. Matt, a new chairman come in and just told me straight away, I don't want you as manager. And he kicked me out straight away. And I just said from that day, I said, well, this is not for me. I better find myself a job outside football. And that's when I went into finance, and I was in finance all my life.
I appreciate your time, Ali. Very gracious of you. Let's tell people where they can find your book, Thou Shall Not Pass.
I didn't really want to write the book in the first place. And the reason this is me again, I don't think I'm a big enough star for people to buy it. If I'd been played for Scotland, if we had won cups, if we had done something, yes. But just to play for West Brom and Wolves, and I just said to him, your first set, that's it, gone. Says, and I don't think there's any books left. So I just say, and they wanted to reproduce it. And I just said, no, if it's going to cost me money, no. Because I didn't think it would sell.
It's interesting, though, that we now get players from your era who are releasing autobiographies. And I think it makes them stronger books. I don't think players should be writing their books while they're still playing. So you are now, as a man who's lived twice as long as as his playing days, you're able to look back and tell us about your career and maybe see where you went wrong, where you went right. And I think these books are all the stronger for being written 30 years after the events. Thou Shall Not Pass, the Alistair Robertson story, is available from all good bookshops, the ones that have survived the pandemic, of course. You'd be able to find the book on Amazon and eBay as well, I'm sure, and also directly from the publisher Pitch Publishing. Appreciate your time, Ali. Thank you very much. Full time. Thank you to Alistair for his time. You can still find copies of his book on the usual sites online. It is strange, isn't it, how there are some players who have really strong careers, fighting it out for cups and European positions and league titles. I'm thinking players such as Alistair, Billy Bonds, Howard Kendall, Steve Bruce to pluck a handful out of thin air, and they never even get a single cap for their country. And then you look at some players that did, particularly, say, with England in that dreadful Graham Taylor era of the early 90s, and you think, so so-and-so was in, but so-and-so who played, say, for example, in Alistair Robertson, obviously he was Scottish rather than English, but he played in the top flight for 14 years. He played in Europe. He was in a team that was challenging at the top of the top division for several seasons, and yet he wasn't even worth an appearance in a squad. That is odd, isn't it? That is it for this week. The podcast can be followed on both Twitter and Instagram at Shorts Were Short. You can follow the show on Facebook when Shorts Were Short 2023. If you want to join the group page, please do. And feel free to post on there. The only criteria, it is disregarded by some, but the criteria is each post has to fall within that 1954 to 92 window. That is the historical window. If we don't observe that, we're just another football page. The show is also on Threads at Shorts Were Short. If you want to drop me an email, you can get me shortswereshort@1607westegg.com. Support the show at ko-fi.com/Daniel Ruiz Tyson. That's KiloOscar-FoxtrotIndia.com/Daniel Ruiz Tyson, which will get you access to the show. The Twitter feed is no longer a premium feed. So any shares, retweets of the episode links will be much appreciated, because the visibility now has dwindled dramatically for those posts. Thank you for your time. I've been Daniel Ruiz Tyson. This has been When Shorts Were Short. If the shorts weren't short, we don't talk about it.